Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Thank you. Haven't seen you in a while. Nice to see you. Thank you all for being here. I'm Jim Falk, President of the World Affairs Council of Frisco. Now, we are very pleased to now really begin to have more of a platform here in Collin County, and I want to thank our members for spreading the word and supporting us. And I also want to really extend an invitation to those of you who are visiting with us for the first time. I know some of you came here because of the cooperation that we have with CFA Society. Please go to our website at dfwworld.org to learn about the World Affairs Council. We have, throughout the Metroplex, 4,200 members. And our goal in this year, coming year, is to do probably at least 6 to 8 programs, if not more, depending on the demand in Frisco, as well as about an equal number in McKinney. Let me just give you an idea, for those of you who are not members, of some of the programs that we'll be presenting. And these are 3 or 4 over the course of the next two weeks. Tomorrow, Charles Kupchan will be speaking about Trump's foreign policy. And I joked and said he's probably going to be writing his speech tonight. But in fact, we invited Dr. Kupchan probably about 6 months ago to ask him to speak about the new administration's foreign policy, obviously not knowing who would be the president. And he is just eminently qualified to really give an objective view of some of the things that are and will be occurring. And then many of you have seen Richard Haass on television over the course of the last months. He is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he'll be our speaker on February 16th. But the 2 days before that, and if you're wondering, Mayor, what to do on Valentine's Day, I mean, I know you have dinner plans with Cindy at some exquisite restaurant in Frisco, but now you're going to take her to downtown Dallas to hear Bob Gates on Valentine's Day. Bob Gates is going to be speaking about leadership in the Trump era. So please join us for that. So that just gives you an idea of the type of programs that the World Affairs Council does, and our education programs. We have we reached about 10,000 high school students in 2016 and about 1,500 teachers.
It also gives you an idea of what Jim Falk thinks is romantic.
Oh, that's true, too, yeah. And also, we have a cycling club. I mean, you know, lots of activities at the council, and we have restaurants and film premieres. You know, we're doing a number of film premieres in Frisco and Addison in March. So that gives you a sense. Now, who's the best ambassador when you talk about the diplomatic corps? Who's the best ambassador in North Texas? There he is. Come on up here and say a few words for us, Mayor Matto.
Thank you, Jim. A few words and mayor of a city don't go too well together, just for the record. But yeah, but no, I want to. My job is really to welcome everybody here. If you're not from Frisco, welcome to Frisco. And if you're from Frisco, it's good to see you. And hopefully, you're enjoying the growth out here. You know, I only have one thing to say, Jim. Last year, Harry and I spent a lot of time overseas, and whether we were in the UK and we did China and Japan and Korea. And Harry, all I got to say is one thing. I'm glad we did that last year, because if we went now, all we'll be talking about is U.S. foreign policy, right? So, but we were talking about jobs. And Frisco is still one of the fastest growing cities in the U.S. We have a lot going on here. Just look around the Cranes, world headquarters, the Cowboys, and just a very young community with about a median age of 122,000. So it is still filling out. Today, we're at 160,000 people. Put in perspective, when I was elected to council before mayor in the year 2000, we were 33,000 people. So we've had 130,000 people since. And it's been a great team. Great part of that growth has been the people we have. So with that, I want our members of our Economic Development Corporation that are here, Frisco EDC, to raise their hands so you can see who they are. Harry's in the back and over here. And former members, too, you can raise your hand. So these are people involved in our international efforts in creating jobs. I also have a former council member with us, Bart Crowder, right there. So the people that are involved in Frisco stay involved in Frisco. So without any further ado,
yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so you're going to get up there. All right, so we have a great guest speaker here, but we have one of our council members, Tim Nelson. Saw him get up. Where'd he go? There he is, standing in the back. Tim Nelson serves on our city council, and in most cities, that means just coming to a couple of meetings a month. In Frisco, it means doing something every day. And so it's my pleasure to introduce Tim Nelson, who will introduce our guest speaker.
Excellent. Thank you. Good. Yeah, I got it. Thank you, Tim. It's good to see you.
Appreciate it, sir. Hi, good morning. How are you all doing today? Excellent. All right. Well, I'm excited about our guest speaker today. I have the pleasure of introducing him, so I'm very excited about that, especially after reading a little bit more about him. We're pleased to be joined this morning by Abdul Aziz Al-Naim. Mr. Al-Naim is founder and managing partner of Myar Capital Group, where he gained insight into investment behavior and how human instincts affect an individual's investments. For the 7 years prior to founding Myar, he served as chairman, CEO, and fund manager of Yareem Limited, an investment company which he managed using a disciplined value investing approach. He was also chairman of Yareem Arabia, a multi-unit restaurant company based in Saudi Arabia for the years 2005 to 2011. Mr. Al-Naim currently serves as a member of several advisory boards and boards of director, including Basic Chemical Industries, GIB Capital, the Saudi Association for Investment Professionals, the annual charity run, and Dareem Al-Yai Schools. Mr. Al-Naim is a founding board member of Ocal Angel Investors Network Eastern Province Chapter. He is a CFA charter holder and a member of CFA Bahrain and CFA UK. He holds a BS in management science with a concentration in finance and a minor in economics from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Here to discuss his work with Myar Capital Group and their approach to investment risk and investment behavior, please join me in welcoming Abdul Aziz Al-Naim to the podium.
I saw it in his eyes. I was sure he was just going to jump. Just jumped up in front. So he has the energy to do so for sure.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for coming this morning, and it's a real pleasure. I've never been to Frisco, so it's a pleasure to be here. I've heard amazing things, and I hope that I can share some of the lessons that I've learned over the past few years on investing. I joke that I picked this topic months ago, and I did not expect it to be so relevant to the times we are living in today. So just to make the lawyers happy, this basically says that this is my opinion, and believe it or not, I can be wrong sometimes. So I think we did the introduction, but I wanted to just tell you a little bit about how we invest. So we invest, our team is based in London. We invest globally, mostly in developed markets, so North America, Western Europe, but we also invest in Asia and some emerging markets from time to time. I think what characterizes probably the key to what we do is our approach is following something called value investing. And the idea of value investing, or the principles behind it, were first developed in the 1930s by a guy in New York called Ben Graham. And in 1934, Ben Graham and David Dodd, who was teaching at Columbia at the time, wrote a book called Security Analysis, which is probably the first scientific approach to investing ever written. And since then, it's been known as the Value Investor's Bible. Ben Graham's most famous student is Warren Buffett, but pretty much everybody who studied under Ben Graham has had just an absolutely fascinating and interesting, successful investment career. And the other thing that is, I think, key to value investing, at least how we approach it, is a long-term approach. So we are extremely patient. We go in basically into an investment thinking that we'd be willing to hold it 5-10 years into the future. And I think that gives us a tremendous edge in how we analyze investments and how we make decisions. Now, something that we've been playing around a lot with lately is the idea of uncertainty and how to deal with uncertainty. So I'll get in a little bit about how we've applied it to investing. But I'm going to take a step back and talk about what I think is my personal journey from a thinking approach that I believe was deterministic to an approach to decision-making and thinking that's probabilistic. And I'll tell you how this journey started. So a lot of people, a lot of professionals, usually tend to read very narrowly within their field. And I've always had a very different opposite approach to that. I think that reading in other fields is not a waste of time. And I've always thought about it as thinking, collecting thinking tools from other disciplines. And I found over the years that at the intersection of disciplines, you gain a very different perspective from other people who may be in your field. One of my heroes, Charlie Munger at Berkshire Hathaway, calls it building a lattice work of mental models. And I love that he used the word lattice work, but it gives you the idea that this is a three-dimensional approach to thinking versus a more two-dimensional approach if you were very narrowly focused on your field of work. So I'm going to take an example from physics and then try to go from there to our approach to investing and finance, and then try to get some broader lessons from it for management and decision-making in general. So I think in physics, when Newtonian physics was the rule of the game, the world was extremely deterministic. So in Newtonian physics, you knew exactly what was happening at any moment in time. But more importantly, if you had enough information, in theory, you can predict the future. Predicting the future was not an issue of impossibility, it was an issue of practicality. And then over time, as physics developed and people started to look at smaller and smaller things and got into the small particle world, they discovered a world that looks very different from the deterministic world that everybody lived in. So at the particle level, everything is probabilistic. And just to highlight what that means, there's a famous thought experiment in quantum mechanics called Schrodinger's cat. And Schrodinger, who came up with this thought experiment in the 1930s, was a physicist who tried to explain, to find an easier way to explain the probabilistic nature of the world at the very, very tiny scale. And so the thought experiment goes something like this. You get a box and you put a cat in that box. And in that box, you place a very special kind of jar that's full of poison, but that jar will release that poison with a 50-50 chance. So when you put the jar inside the box, you are not sure whether that poison is going to be released this time around. And then you cover the box. Now, eventually, when you open the box, the cat is going to be either dead or alive. But until you open the box, the only way of describing the status of the cat is both dead and alive with a 50-50 chance. So until you actually get to the final outcome, the current state of the cat is probabilistic. You cannot actually say if it's dead or alive. Now, what does that mean? So take that idea, I've taken that idea and tried to think about some of the things that we do in investing. I think finance in general, and investing especially, has not moved in the same direction that physics has. The world of investing and finance is still extremely deterministic. People always talk about what is and what will happen. And I think that's extremely misguided. So in business school, they teach you that if you want to estimate the value of a stock, for example, you're supposed to do what is called a discounted cash flow. And that basically means that you have to forecast sales 5, 10, 20 years into the future, forecast margins for the same amount of time, and then go from there and forecast what the amount of free cash flow that the business is going to generate over that period. And then you're supposed to pick a discount rate to bring the fair value of those free cash flows back to today, and then you come up with a number. And you say, this fair value of this stock is $12.50. And that is a very deterministic way of looking at things. And when I was in school, that's what they taught us. And when I got out, and actually started to think about how business works and what the world is like, I started playing around and doing ranges. So I'd say, well, what happens if we tweak this a little bit? What happens if we change the growth rate a little bit? What happens if margin in year 10 is different? And do some sensitivity or analysis around that, kind of a different scenarios of what could happen. And the natural extension of that playing around, essentially, with the idea is to get to what we now do at Mayar Capital, which is to simulate. And I know when people start hearing simulation, they freak out, and it sounds like it's complicated. And I mean, the math can get a bit complicated, but the actual outcome is more important than the technicalities of how it's done. But essentially, instead of saying, so let's say this is $12.50. This is basically the central point of what a stock supposedly is worth in a deterministic world. A probabilistic approach would say, well, it's worth $12.50, but there's a chance it's worth this and it's worth this. And there are many scenarios, and this could be tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of scenarios that you run, and it'll give you a graph that looks like this. And in most cases, the most important thing to learn is just to try to think of the world as outcomes with probabilities around them, as opposed to single points that are discrete and unique. And once you start thinking of the world in this way, it changes how you make decisions, I think. It changes, most importantly, I think it changes your approach to risk. I think one of the biggest problems that finance has suffered in the past is trying to think of things as an either or. And that's probably one reason why we got into trouble and almost brought the whole world down in 2008. So, what are the key benefits to this approach to thinking? I think the first key benefit is that once you run that simulation, instead of coming up with the numbers, you end up with a graph. And the shape of the graph in and of itself is informative. And so here are two different distributions around essentially the same outcome. So this is still 1250, and this is still 1250 a share. But in the first case, you see that there's all this area of potential outcomes that are very high on this end. Whereas here, this is a very tight distribution around the 1250. Now, if this graph was the other way around, you probably want to avoid this investment, because what this would tell you if it was on the other side is that, yes, you think it's worth 1250, but there are some pretty nasty outcomes on the left side of the graph. Whereas in this, if the graph is shaped like this, well, this is worth 1250, but there is a really significant chance of it being worth a lot more. So this is something where if you get in there, your downside is limited, but your upside is very, very high. So the shape of the curve is very informative in and of itself, in addition to just the central point. The other thing that you get out of it is if you run a simulation, you end up with a graph that looks like this. This is called the tornado graph, and it looks pretty scary, I know. But all it's saying here is it's going and measuring the sensitivity of your model to your assumptions. So everybody who makes a prediction is essentially making either explicit or implicit assumptions about the future. What this does, which is why I think it's extremely valuable, it brings out your assumptions to the surface and makes them very explicit. And until you are very clear about what is it that you're assuming, you will not make good decisions. A lot of bad decisions are made because we implicitly assume something not knowing that we're actually assuming that. So that's the second benefit of doing a simulation. The third benefit is what I call a broken thesis. So a broken thesis is basically you can get into a situation, in this case a stock, and you buy it, and the stock goes up, but goes up for the wrong reason. So we assume that something is going to happen, and you say, I'm going to buy the stock because 1, 2, and 3 are going to happen, but 1, 2, and 3 don't happen, but the stock goes up nonetheless. Now, most people feel good about themselves, give themselves a pat on the back that they've made a good decision. But actually, they've done a terrible decision. That's an example of a broken thesis where you were actually wrong, you just got lucky. And running a simulation helps you detect that by making your assumptions explicit and that you can compare them to the actual outcome. The flip side of it, of course, is that you can also be wrong for the right reasons. So you can assume something, that thing is supposed to happen, but then through bad luck, the outcome can still be a negative outcome. So this stuff, the numbers are easy, but changing your thinking to embrace that approach to investing is extremely hard. I've found it extremely hard. I still make a lot of mistakes where I find myself thinking in a very deterministic way. But I think it's essential that we change the way we think to more of a probabilistic approach, whether it's in investing in finance or life in general. So how can you do that? How can you change how you think? So I think the first thing that you need to do, and some people find this silly, but I really think it matters, is change your language. So how you speak about things. So the first thing, which is very, very hard for anyone to say, but especially people in finance, because we usually have huge egos. So saying, I don't know, it's probably those three words are the hardest three words to say. You certainly won't be invited again on CNBC if they ask you a question and you say, I don't know. But the reality is for almost anything that we're trying to predict in the future, the actual real answer is I don't know. You can have a guess, but until you actually say I don't know, you're tricking yourself into thinking that your guess is actually reality. So I think learning to say I don't know is really key. The second example of a change in language is, and the British use this a lot, they always say I reckon. So they say I reckon that this and this happened, or I reckon that this and this is going to happen, versus I believe. And the reason I think changing, making the switch is key is when you say I reckon, you're explicitly inviting the chance that you might be wrong. And not only does it say that, are you saying that to yourself, but you're saying that to the person you're talking to. And if they come and say, well, I think something else may happen, it's not threatening because you didn't say it with a strong enough language to start with. So it invites people to come and tell you things that are against what you just claimed may happen. Versus when I say, I believe this and that is going to happen, you basically, they'll be afraid to come and approach you because they're basically coming and saying you're absolutely wrong. So I think that's another benefit of it. And the last one, which is, I think, key, especially in writing, so journalists, analysts who write report, to change the way they think, they write things and say X, whatever it is more likely to happen instead of saying X will happen. So interest rates are more likely to be raised in 2017 versus interest rates are going to go up in 2017. And again, it's same as I reckon and I believe. I think helps you think better, helps you and helps the people sitting across from you come back to you with opposing information. The other thing that we found useful is, when I got sat with my team and we wrote these things down, is to stop using single point estimates. Just never, whenever you're trying to predict anything, never write down a single number if it's a number. Always simulate, use ranges, put down several scenarios. You will never have a world where every estimate that you make is going to be spot on. And just changing, so it's meaningless to go about putting in point single estimates down. The second one is don't believe your own hype. You're going to be wrong about the future. So act accordingly. Admit that it's going to be wrong. And when it comes to risk, for example, go in making decisions with that in mind. Another one that there's a great book called Super Forecasters that came out last year that talks about good forecasters. And one of the things that they do is they constantly update expectations. So as new information comes in, they're not embarrassed to go and change their prediction. And they're constantly changing their views over time instead of saying this will happen and just sticking to it. And then the last one, I think, that people will always judge your decisions based on the outcome, which is a terrible way of judging decisions because low probability events do happen. It's called bad luck. And you need to resist the, and it works both ways. Again, good things could happen that were not supposed to happen. So you need to resist that temptation. And finally, to just stop craving certainty. It's very hard. Human beings are naturally like certainty, and just you need to train yourself to stop craving it. The world is complex and very unpredictable. Accept it, embrace that uncertainty, and then develop and keep improving your thinking and physical tools to deal with that uncertainty. And keep the conversation going. Thank you.
And Nicole, is Tom there? Is he?
You're supposed to. We'll get that podium back.
Well, if we were, had been talking, say, a year ago, there are two assumptions that we might have agreed on. One, that President Trump would not be President Trump, and that the UK would not be about to invoke an article to exit Brexit. So I'd like to ask you, how do you evaluate now what may be happening in Europe and the United States, especially with the rise of this populist movement?
So, I mean, the Trump election is just the last of what has been a shift. It's harder to see shifts in the U.S. because you basically have a two-party system, whereas in Europe, where they have multiple parties, it's easier to see the political landscape shifting slowly over time. So there's been a shift towards populism for the essentially since the financial crisis. This just I think just tipped over the past year with things. We saw it in Greece when the Greeks in the Greek referendum when they rejected the bailout. Their government eventually ignored the referendum and did whatever they wanted to do. But there's been this general shift. And we were talking about basically what I think are some of the fundamentals underlying that. And I think one of the fundamentals underlying that shift is that the forces of globalization and capitalism are net positive for society and for people. Mm-hmm. However, and this is something that Adam Smith identified very early on, there are fictional costs in the form of people who do fall through the cracks. So everybody may be better off, but there are people who do lose. And I think it is the winner's duty in rich societies to help ease a transition for people who, through bad luck, happen to be victims of that. So take some of the gains. Those are net gains from globalization. Take some of those gains and give them back to people who were on the wrong side of it, instead of ignoring them, which is what we've done for so long, and then have them get angry, and rightfully so, and basically try to kill the goose that's laying the golden egg.
You know, clearly NAFTA is going to be reevaluated in some way, and I'm interviewing on the phone President Fox this Friday, and I was reading a report from the Fed, and I saw that Texas actually, when NAFTA was put in place, lost 50,000 jobs. And yet we clearly view NAFTA, by and large, as being a successful benefit for the state of Texas. So when you say there's a responsibility for the winners, are you saying that it should be, when you said society, you used the word society, what is society? Is that the government or is that the companies or...
So I'd be very reluctant to have companies do it because I don't want to mess with the market system. The market system works really well. But I mean, there are examples of countries that have successfully done it. So Germany, for example, has done a good job. The UK has done a terrible job, for example. And the way they've done it, they've had companies basically pay into a pool.
And so companies are paying into the pool?
Well, companies paid money, but they didn't actually have to do the details. It's essentially a... part of the tax is being diverted to a pool that helps retrain people in new skills who lose their jobs through the transition.
You know, when you look at how jobs have been lost, you know, the term creative destruction and so forth, automation's played a huge role. And how do you retrain someone who may have been working in an automotive plant or any type of manufacturing facility and they're 55, 60 years old?
Yeah, I think in the U.S., for example, the numbers, the estimates are that about 85% of net manufacturing jobs lost were lost to automation, not to offshoring or whatever. And actually, one of the other myths is that the manufacturing base in the U.S. has eroded, and actually that's not true. If you look at the manufacturing value in the U.S., it's been a straight line up.
Productivity's gone up.
Productivity has just gone up so much that the labor input into a car has gone down by an order of magnitude in one generation. I think it's tricky. I don't claim that it's going to be an easy thing to do, especially with people who are very late into their career. But I think there must be something that we can do, either as a government in a rich society. We all benefit from globalization. We all benefit from automation. We all benefit from trade. But if there are people who suffer, and I just don't think it's okay. I don't think it's even good for the economy to have so many people lose their jobs in a short amount of time. That's going to have a hit on discretionary income. So helping them out one way or another to either gain new skills or ease them out of the workforce, I think will still be a net positive, even if it has short-term costs.
Let me bring you back to the United States and Mexico. Because you know there is talk about a potential trade war. Is there a way for the United States and Mexico to reach some type of compromise with either country losing face? Because right now you have Peña Nieto and Trump who are really in a position where obviously Trump does not want to lose his base. Peña Nieto already has, but what should they do if you were advising?
Change the outcome of the election.
That democracy just gets in the way.
I think the sad thing is that, and this happens, I mean, all the time in business and in politics, of course, is that people make decisions and make claims that leaves them no way back.
Yeah.
And that's just terrible positioning. When you basically put yourself in a corner.
But often they ignore those positions, and what we're seeing with President Trump is he's just been going right down the list.
Yeah, I mean, an example of trade between the U.S. and Mexico, the U.S. And Mexico, yes, the U.S. has a trade deficit with Mexico, but actually a lot of that is debatable. The numbers hide a lot of the details. So, for example, the largest export from Mexico to the U.S. is cars and auto parts, and the largest export from the U.S. to Mexico is also cars and auto parts. And if you actually look at the value chain of automotive manufacturing, you can eliminate about a third of the trade deficit if you actually counted the parts right. So a lot of auto parts will go across border several times in the manufacturing and assembly of a car in the U.S., for example. So it gets counted wrong. That being said, it almost the facts don't matter anymore, and I think it's going to be more of a political political problem than an economic one.
Did I understand correctly last night that your company either owns or has a heavy investment in Nordstrom?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So, you know, we've just seen that Macy's is closing dozens of stores, laying off, I think, several thousand people. For the first time, my wife and I did not go to a mall this year at Christmas. We did everything basically online. So how do you assess what may be happening, one, with these large department stores, of which we have so many in Dallas-Fort Worth, and real estate plays with malls?
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about this on the way up here, actually. It's really interesting that you asked that. So, basically, most of this has been driven by online retailing. So as online penetration has gone up as a percentage of retail sales, people, like you said, go less to the malls and go less to the local stores. And one of the people, I mean, Macy's is closing 100 stores. The Limited just announced they're going to close 250 stores. Many retailers have been suffering the past 2 years because of this transition. And there are basically side effects of that, like the mall owners and then the mm-hmm. ecosystem that has sprung up around malls.
All the restaurants and everything.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, there's an argument that people like Best Buy used to make. And they came up with a word for it. They called it showrooming. That basically a lot of the stuff that people are buying on Amazon, before they buy it, they actually have to go to a physical store, try it out, check it out, and then order online. And that if the store was gone, they would not be able to, Amazon would not be able to capture those sales. And people used to think that argument is silly, but there is some evidence now in Amazon opening its own brick and mortar stores now that actually made there may be truth to that. I think as a retailer, I mean, one of the reasons we've been invested in Nordstrom for I think 12 years now that we've owned Nordstrom. And Nordstrom has done an amazing job in basically catabolizing its own sales. So the very early on, they said, if we just sit back, someone else is going to generate those online sales. So we can sit back and ignore the problem, or we can just cannibalize our own sales. So they've invested very, very heavily, very early on in online. They now have the highest penetration of online sales of any department stores. And the reason I think they've been able to do, which is an argument that invites a bigger question, is the Nordstrom family has a big stake in the business, and they've been able to push the company to think very long term. So I remember years ago, management came and said, listen, this is our plan, and we're going to invest heavily in an online infrastructure. It's going to hurt margins. It's going to take up a lot of cash in the form of CapEx. But this is the only way to protect the business and keep it growing, even if it meant that we're going to earn less money this year, next year, and the next 5 years. And that's a very hard thing for a publicly traded company to do. But with the family's backing, they were able to do that. And I think we're now starting to see the evidence that that approach to long-term thinking is going to be key in essentially this war versus people like Macy's who have been more driven to generating earnings this quarter and next quarter. Now, the bigger question that I think is, again, starting to see with people like Nordstrom is, great, you've built up your online sales now, but fewer and fewer sales are generated at your physical location. So eventually, you're still going to probably have to shut down some of those stores. And I think this is an evolving landscape that...
That you'll be following closely.
Yeah, I am.
Let me ask you to put that on a bell curve for a second. So you've got Nordstrom on one of your ranges, and you've got Alibaba on the other, and somewhere in your bell is Amazon. Where's your ranges?
So I think one thing that's helped Nordstrom is that Amazon still hasn't figured out how to sell fashion online. It's been one of the hardest things to sell. People like to try on clothes. Sizing is tough, and it's one of those things that... That being said, their online sales keep to go up. Net-a-Porter in Europe has been growing really fast. People have figured out that, you know what, I'll order two sizes and then try them out and return... whichever one I don't like, or return both, and returns have been easier. The UK, for example, has been really good at that because they have centers where you can return things within a 5-minute walk of where you live. So that's helped. So I think the physical infrastructure is still evolving to support what is still a change. I mean, online retail is still a very low percentage of total retail sales.
But increasing
yeah. really fast. Right. So it's still changing. I think we're still figuring it out. It's what, sorry?
Smallest market.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. I think it's...
Well, you know, I'm glad that I actually pay someone else to handle the little Falk investment fund, but, you know, I'm so surprised, frankly, that the market is over 20,000. And also with Brexit, the UK investment climate is strong. You know, there's not been the anticipated drop that everyone talked about in June and early July. What do you think the reason is for both countries?
So more recent.
And how stable is it, I think?
Yeah. I mean, specifically on the Dow is just a terrible measure of the market level. It's just a bad index that should not exist. But we can get into the technicalities of how it's calculated. But I mean, I think the market in the U.S., for example, is definitely assuming that everything on the positive end of expectations for a Trump administration is going to do is going to happen, mm-hmm. and assigning very little weight to the bad outcomes. That potentially could happen. There was actually a piece this morning in Bloomberg about Ray Dalio, who's the manager at Bridgewater, the largest hedge fund in the world, essentially switching. He was very bullish on the Trump administration yesterday. He came out and said he's actually changed his mind, and he thinks that the likelihood has shifted to more of the bad, negative outcome happening instead of the positive ones. I think the market has gotten a little bit ahead of itself in the U.S. I think in the U.K., the local economy and exporters have benefited a lot from the depreciation of the pound. Mm-hmm. But this is in terms of the Brexit evolution, this is as good as it's going to get, I think, mm-hmm. for the British economy. And assuming that this is a new norm, is just completely wrong, I think. I think they're heading for a big disappointment.
And you know, we had Sebastian Mallaby with us earlier this week. Sebastian is the author of this new book on Alan Greenspan, but is well known for his columns in the Washington Post, and he said exactly the same thing, that don't bet on this continuing. Let's open it up. Questions, thoughts? Yes, sir. And if you could, I don't think we need a mic, but if you'll speak loud.
I think the answer to that is to look at the actual mix of what's being manufactured. I agree with you about the in terms of jobs being the case. So a lot of low-value manufacturing left the U.S. When that happened. And the U.S. is a big enough market that it actually, from a logistics point of view, it still makes sense to import a lot of the low-value products. Germany has done a great job transitioning people in those industries. The U.S., the U.K. has not. The U.K. has done an even worse job than the U.S. In doing that. But this goes back to what I was saying earlier. Low-value manufacturing will move to the lowest cost. And that's not a disaster. The disaster is to not transition the same people to start making higher-value manufactured goods. I think that's where it is. It's become that. It's become on the low end of things. I mean, this is why, I mean, if you look at again, it depends on the type of car. So small cars, for example, are very low end. I think the average manufacturer makes a couple of $100s of net profit on an automobile in the U.S., which is within the percentage of value is actually really small. Whereas some of the other, I mean, think of, let me take a step back. Also, the definition of what manufacturing is. So if you look at something like an iPhone, Is an iPhone a manufactured good, and where is it manufactured? If you look at the value of an iPhone, 90%+ of the value is actually captured in the United States. The software, the design, and the services. And only the low-end assembly is done in China. So is the iPhone manufactured in China, or is it actually manufactured in the US? The definitions can betray us, I think. And why is it that assembling the iPhone is necessarily valuable versus having people who have the skills to design it and create it and market it and write the software and services that are associated with it? So I think changing, we can also lose a lot in terms of semantics and in some cases.
Go ahead.
So the thing with simulation is junk in, junk out. You put in terrible assumptions, you end up with terrible estimates. A lot of what goes into figuring out the assumptions or assumption ranges in the case of simulation is qualitative. So a lot of qualitative things that you need to assess and use your judgment to... And that's otherwise it'd just be too easy. If it was just a matter of... I think in most cases, you have a long enough investment horizon, a lot of the other stuff doesn't matter. So we're very bottoms up. We look at individual businesses. We like to buy them when they're reasonably priced. And we like, I mean, that curve that I put up, we like curves where heads... I win a lot, and tails, I don't lose too much.
What is your view on America backing away from the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
I think it's stupid.
I agree.
I think the TPP, unfortunately, for many reasons, has been marketed as a free trade agreement, where I think the bulk of what the TPP is a geopolitical affiliation in what is going to be the key region in the next 100 years. And I think America backing out of it is basically giving China the region. And I think it's... not that I have something against the Chinese, but in terms of where we want the world's social and economic values to evolve, that is a terrible thing for humanity in general.
Do you think Australia, which has been talked about in the press, and I know from conversations in Mexico that Mexico might go this way too, that they'll try to reconstitute it without the United States and bring in China?
I mean, the world we live in, this post-World War II world, has been built essentially, the systems and the institutions have been built by the United States. Mm-hmm. And it's a world and a system that has some issues, but it works. And we need to keep improving on it. This is, I think it's the system that the US has of liberal democracy, rule of law, and open markets is, in my opinion, one of humanity's greatest achievements. And this is a system that works, and we need to stick to it. And we need to, there are going to be mistakes. We're human beings. We're going to make mistakes. We need to learn from them. And we need to fix those mistakes, but we should not abandon a system that that has worked and has proven to work. I mean, the system that people like President Trump's are essentially advancing, mercantilism. Go back and read Adam Smith. Adam Smith talked about why it's a terrible system. We've tried. Humanity has tried it before. It doesn't work.
Frank.
What?
Yeah.
Did that continue without America?
I hope. I hope that cooler heads eventually prevail. We'll see.
Frank?
If we agree with your assumption that the market is high, it's been frothy and mostly based on very positive expectations about what's going to happen and what the effects are. Then what type of specific defensive moves would you make other than to adopt Professor Swenson's idea that you've got to diversify widely? What kind of investments and what places would you look to put capital in for the next several years?
So until very recently, probably until now, equities have been and probably continue to be the best house in a terrible neighborhood. Central banks have pushed interest rates so low, in the case of Europe, into negative. And that's basically by design is being done to push people to take more risk. And if you look at equities, for example, now relative to fixed income, and they in a relative sense, they still look better. In an absolute sense, they don't look so great. I think non-U.S. equity markets look a little bit cheaper. They're not cheap, but essentially, we live in a world where central banks are essentially punishing savers on purpose. To try to simulate the economy, and I'm not sure that there's limits to whether it actually works or not, and then taking it out is going to be really scary. How they're going to be able to do it? I wish I have a better answer. We've been holding some extra cash more recently because we can't find a lot of good ideas to invest in.
Go ahead, sir.
My favorite science fiction movies is Blade Runner, and there's a corporation there where there's a CEO and one worker. Is there, for society's sake, is there a limit to technological development? How would you approach that?
So in the early 20th century, Keynes, I think, wrote about what he perceived to be a new challenge that human beings are going to face, which is they're going to have so much leisure time because of automation that they're not going to know what to do with it. People work more today than they've ever done. I don't know. When it comes to estimating the future, people, it seems, always underestimate the human ingenuity and the ability of human beings to create better things and create better lives for themselves.
You know, Aziz, I don't want to let you off the stage without asking you to comment on Saudi Arabia, because there's been so many, or was that what you're going to, there have been so many recent articles on all sides of the equation. Saudi Arabia is involved in a very expensive war in Yemen. The dollar amount is just shocking, $6 billion a month or something.
Who's counting?
Yeah, who's counting? Even for Saudi Arabia, reserves have dropped precipitously. Subsidies are been reduced, if not eliminated, for fuel. The kingdom has eliminated a lot of jobs. Princes have even been cut back on some of their stipends. How stable is Saudi Arabia?
So I think in the short term, the biggest challenge has been balancing the budget. The budget deficit has just been insane. And I think the government has... It's amazing what you can do if you don't have to run for your re-election. They've been able to basically cut...
We don't want to go there here yet.
Who knows? They've been able to basically cut... a lot of subsidies have been either cut or are being cut over time. The government, for example, has cut salaries for government employees by 20-30%. I think they're on track. There are some legacy projects that are still ongoing, but once you take those out on a structural basis, they're going to balance the budget within the next 2 or 3 years. So that's the easy work. The hard work that still needs to be done is once you've done all this austerity, you're basically really hurting the local economy. And while oil is a big percent, it's about 50 to 60% of GDP, you've still got another 40-50% of non-oil economy, and that's going to suffer a lot because discretionary spending is just collapsing. The middle class don't have any incremental income to spend on discretionary purchases. And, okay, you balance the budget, you reduce the government's role in an economy that's for too long dependent on it. But then what? Can you actually find and implement the right policies to encourage entrepreneurship, to encourage new business formation and job creation? Because that's really the only way to grow the economy without going back into the same habit of the government spending in and stimulating the economy and this cycle of dependence that's been going on for too long. I think it's going to be really, really tricky. One of their goals, which I think is misguided, is or just unrealistic, is to reduce the economy's dependence on oil. Hmm. And I don't think that's possible or necessarily even required. I think the government budget can be run in a way where it's counter-cyclical to the oil cycle, and that kind of helps the oil side of the economy weather the volatility of oil prices. But then if you can create higher value industries around oil and gas, so you basically capitalize on your strengths and move downstream, for example, in oil, try to develop some of the technologies. Saudi Arabia imports way, way too much oil and gas technology from other countries, mm-hmm. which is a joke given the size of...
So what's your view about the sale of what a minority interest in Aramco?
I think it's going to happen. I think the Crown Prince has just said it way too many times for him to back down from it. And some of the people who have been working on it, I know the investment banks have been preparing for it. So I think it's going to happen. The shape and form of it is going to be something that we still need to see. There's still, I think, there are questions about whether the reserves are going to be part of it or not. But those can be sorted out, and the market's going to be able to price it accordingly. He's said, I mean, if you read between the lines, it seems he said, officially he said they're going to sell up to 5%, but if you read between the lines of some of his statements, it sounds like he wants to sell down the government stake over time to just over 50%. I think that's going to be interesting because if they can manage to do that and change the way the government income comes instead of having it straight from Aramco and have maybe more of an international ownership of Aramco, I think it'll do a few good things. It'll obviously increase transparency and accountability at Aramco, which in international terms, especially in national oil companies, actually extremely well run.
Yeah, it has been for a long time.
But I think reducing the government's income dependence from oil to other sources is a good in and of itself.
Good. Well, I want to thank you for being with us. Thank all of you, and can we stay in touch?
Absolutely.
Come back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And for those of you who are wondering, he got his tie last night. The World Affairs Council tie. Thanks. Great being with you. Sorry we didn't have more time to spend.